maybe better to do a Vajrasattva retreat or something like that. One of our teachers, Geshe-to Jampa-tekchok, who after he was our teacher at Manjushri Institute, he became the abbot of Sarajay Monastery for many years. So again, Tekchok, when he was teaching us tenets, I think it was this class, he said that the lamas say that studying tenets, you know, to learn these systems, creates more merit, even creates more purification than doing a Vajrasattva retreat. So you can feel some confidence that this is not a, you know, just a sort of intellectual procedure, an intellectual scholastic thing that has no spiritual value, because we're setting down the foundational terms and understandings to study the greater texts. Lama Zopa Rinpoche often says that to really understand emptiness, if you really want to understand emptiness, you have to study the great treatises, Nargarjuna's texts, especially Chandrakirti's explanation on Nargarjuna, so forth. And to read those texts and to understand them, what we're studying now is a very important prerequisite, you might say, because Chandrakirti refers to these various, and Nargarjuna refer to these various Buddhist tenets. They assume the various concepts that we were talking about in Lohrig and other things. So very, very useful. Very, very useful. Okay, so right now we're delving into a couple of the points of the Vaibhashika system. For instance, for Vaibhashika, ultimate truths are things that cannot be destroyed either physically. That still, let's say, even if you destroy or try to destroy the thing physically or through analysis, deconstruct it, that entity will still appear itself to your mind. Appear to your mind. So they accept the partless moments of time and consciousness, and also in permanent phenomena such as the two cessations and selflessness as being permanent phenomena. Remember in Lohrig we were mentioning when, according to the Sautrantika system, which we're going to be talking about next, according to the Sautrantika system, when you have a realization of selflessness, a direct realization of selflessness, selflessness is not actually directly perceived. It's perceived with a direct perceiver, but it doesn't appear to that consciousness directly. You are understanding selflessness indirectly. What you are perceiving with the mental consciousness, with bare perception, is actually what? You're perceiving the impermanence of the five aggregates, which is an impermanent phenomena. For Sautrantika, impermanent phenomena, you're perceiving it directly, and indirectly you're knowing, therefore, that the person is empty of being permanent. Usually we say permanent, partless, and independent. So, excuse me. Generally, the Vaibhashika accepts two levels of selflessness, at least some of the Vaibhashika. The main one that they accept, that they refute, the self that they refute, is a kind of self that's posited by the non-Buddhist Indian schools, they talk about this Atma, like in the Vedic studies, they talk about an Atma or self, which is permanent. In a sense, also, you know, they say permanent. Probably what they're meaning is eternal, but they say permanent, not changing moment by moment. Partless, it doesn't have any parts. The Atma is just one thing. And independent of the gross body and mind. So that is that particular kind of self that appears doesn't, from the higher school's point of view, higher philosophical tenets in the Vaibhashika, that particular kind of self is not naturally appearing to our mind. It only appears to our mind if we've studied Hindu Vedic tenets and are contemplating that kind of self. It's what's called a, you okay? Is it not, you're trying to find a good place where there's not too much air blowing or what? You want more air or you want less air? Less. You can come sit up here. It's very little air up here. So a self that is permanent, partless, and independent. How could you refute that if you perceived the impermanence of the self that did exist? According to the Vaibhashika, the self that does exist is impermanent. And generally, that's what they're, in order to realize selflessness, the object that they're realizing directly is impermanence. Indirectly, they realize, so they're sort of like, although they're perceiving it with a mental consciousness, so you give analogy with the eyes, you're looking at the impermanence, and indirectly you're understanding that there is no permanence there. You're directly understanding impermanence. Indirectly, you're knowing there's no permanence there, which is not, permanence is not an object that can be known by direct perception, according to the both Sautrantika and Vaibhashika. It's something which is an intellectual construct. Okay. So, let's see here. So some of the sub-schools, these 18 schools, assert the existence of a person that is neither the same as nor different than the mental and physical aggregates. So generally, the Vaibhashika say and the Sautrantika say that the person is, you know, although there is a lack of a certain kind of person that's appearing to our mind, let's say a permanent person, there still is a person. And what is that person? Sometimes people, some of the Vaibhashikas say it is the continuum of the aggregates, the five aggregates. Some say, no, that's not exactly, it's not so much the physical aggregates, it's just a continuum of the mental consciousness. But there are some Vaibhashikas who, they talk about a person that is neither the same as any of the aggregates, nor different. So if it's, generally you think if something is not the same as something or different than it, it wouldn't exist. Like something which is not the same as this cup, can you imagine that? You know, this rosary is not the same as this cup, my eyeglasses are not the same as this cup, I am not the same as the cup. But not, on the other hand, not different than the cup. Well, all those things I enumerated are different than the cup, so there's some kind of netherland there. Some of these positions, interestingly, are later mirrored in higher tenets in a slight variation. But generally, that's those sub-schools aren't part of the main Vaibhashika view. So that's called, in the Vaibhashika, that's called the gross selflessness of persons. The lack of a permanent, partless, and independent self. That's posited by the non-Buddhist schools. They also assert that there is a subtle kind of selflessness, subtle selflessness of persons, which is the lack of a self-supporting, substantially existent self. So you say, wow, that's a lot of words. What does that mean? Let's see if we can break that down. So generally, in between this Vaibhashika and Swatrantika, the Hinayana tenets, they talk about phenomena, I say especially Swatrantika, talk about phenomena that are substantially existent and phenomena which are imputedly existent, imputationally existent, just designatedly existent. What does that mean? Substantially existent phenomena for them are phenomena that will appear to your mind. They have substance, they're substantially existent, and by looking at them, you perceive them, like a cup or a tree. A tree is said to be substantially existent. Example of something which is imputedly existent, existent through the act of imputation, is not something that appears to your senses directly, but something that you can understand implicitly by seeing the bases upon which that thing is imputed. Do you know what I mean by imputed? When you label something, like say a forest. What is a forest? If you look at a group of trees, are you seeing the forest? According to these tenets, lower tenets, a forest is different than a tree. A tree is something that is substantially exists, and if you look at it, the tree appears to you. The substance of the tree is there. Yet a forest is something that you label or impute upon a collection of trees. So as you're looking at the trees, you're just perceiving trees themselves, the substantially existent phenomena. But if you're within your field of vision, or through your understanding, you remembering of seeing these trees, you can implicitly, you know what implicit means? Indirectly. So even though you're seeing the tree or the trees, indirectly, you're understanding this group of trees is a forest. So forest is not something that appears to your mind directly. Let's say to your eyesight. Does that make sense? Mabel, you have a little frown on your face. Or maybe you didn't have a good lunch. So the two kind of phenomena, substantially existent, and implicit and imputationally or designatedly existent or imputedly existent. So another famous example is the rosary. Traditionally, the word for rosary, do you know what it is in Sanskrit? Do you know what they say? We always call these what? Mala. I think that's a Sanskrit word, right? In the titles of various texts, they say the rosary of good advice or something like that. You know, the word mala will come. In Tibetan, it was called tengwa. Teng has to do with counting, so it's something with which you count. The rosary also, the mala, can include things like when you string together a bunch of flowers that you place, like a Hawaiian. We see also in the various ceremonies, sometimes you string together various flowers as ornaments. If they're in a circle, that's called a mala, a rosary. So a rosary, let's say if it's flowers or beads, what you're perceiving are the individual elements, the flowers or the beads. They appear, they're substantially existent. But the rosary itself, you know, you might say, oh yeah, you're looking at the rosary. But the rosary is an intellectual construct, is something that's imputed on a collection of parts. So the rosary doesn't appear directly to, let's say, the eye consciousness or to the tactile consciousness. Say if I'm counting, using it to count beads, you know, with my fingers, you might say I'm perceiving the beads, right? But it, you can understand the rosary, the existence of the rosary. The rosary does exist as an imputedly existent phenomena, designated or imputed upon the collection of parts. So they make that differentiation. Of course, the higher tenets, like the Prasangika, say all phenomena exist by means of imputation on their parts. And they would say even a tree is imputed upon its body, its bark, its leaves, its limbs. But according to these lower tenets, there are some things that just by their nature, they, you know, they're obviously appearing to you. So they're called substantially existence, the substance of that, the substance of the tree, the substance of the mug, whatever appear to you. So if you talk about the person, the subtle selflessness of the person, a person that does exist, the subtle person that does exist, exists as an imputation. It's an imputedly existent upon the five aggregates. Do you remember the five aggregates? Do you know what the five aggregates are? Do you know JT, GTJ, TP? What is it? TP. Do you know the five aggregates? So the five aggregates I explained before. The Buddha explained in this context, talking about imputedly existent, that the person could be divided into parts. You could take all of the physical parts and put in one pile or aggregate of things. The Indian word is skanda. We say the pancha skandas, the five skandas. So all the body elements. Then in another skanda or pile, you can put all of the mental, conscious experiences of pleasure, pain, or indifference, what we call feelings, sensations, feelings, all of those you could put theoretically in another pile. They're immaterial, so you can't physically, you don't see them if you pile them, but just mentally dividing up the person. Also into discriminations, aggregate skanda of discrimination. Then all of the other mental factors besides feeling and discrimination come in another category called the skanda or aggregate of compositional factors, all the things that can cause you to compose karma and so forth. And the fifth aggregate is the aggregate of consciousness. So if you divided a person up into these various things, there should be nothing left. If there was something left, there would have to be another component of the person, another skanda. But supposedly these cover everything of the person. So the person is said to be designated or imputed on this collection of parts, and the person doesn't directly appear to you, the subtle person that's imputed upon them, but it's known implicitly by directly perceiving these five aggregates. Because all of these five things are impermanent, the five aggregates. The person is also impermanent, but the person is imputedly existent. In the same way that the forest is impermanent and it's imputedly existent. Does it make some sense? So one part of this subtle selflessness of person, one part of its definition for the Vaibhashikas, is a person who is devoid of being permanent. What is it? A person who is devoid of being self-sufficient, substantially existent. So the person is not substantially existent. It doesn't appear to your consciousness directly from the substance of person. It's the opposite category of things called imputedly existent phenomena. Okay? Like the rosary, like the forest. And in the other part of this identification of the person that's being refuted is that the person is self-sufficient. So self-sufficient, substantially existent. What that means is when we have a perception of this kind of self, which doesn't really exist, but it appears to our mind. This kind of self appears to our mind from habituation over many, many lifetimes and perceiving our identity this lifetime. The sense of that self is, it turns out that self is only imputedly existent, but when we identify with that self, there's a sense of being not subsidiary to anything else, sort of like the example that's given sometimes is this. If you have a group of merchants, let's say six merchants, one of them might be designated the chief and is not under the sort of like the boss. What do you say in Singapore? Do you say something like, have a word for boss, colloquial term? What? I couldn't hear. Tauge? Something like that. Okay. You can imagine, you know, boss man, sahib. I don't know. Different contexts we have. So it's said that the self, which is imputedly existent, is the chief of these six. It's one of them. And the other five are all subsidiary to it, the five aggregates. So it's part of that group, but it's not any one of the aggregates. So the Vaibhakshika say that the understanding of this kind of self not existing, as you understand the absence of that, or the emptiness of that, or the, you know, that self, there is a selflessness of that, a lack of that kind of self. That is the subtle selflessness of persons. Have you heard that before? Some variation of that. So from the upper, from let's say the Mahayana schools, especially the Majjhimaka schools, the Prasangika in particular, the highest of philosophical schools, the gross selflessness of persons that we've just talked about, the lack of a permanent, partless, and independent self, that's something that's does not appear to the mind naturally. It has to come about because of some wrong instruction. But this lack of a permanent, partless, and independent, lack of this self-sufficient, substantially existent person. There's no substance of person appearing to you. There's no person who is the boss of the other aggregates, sort of like the enjoyer of the aggregates, the enjoyer of the feeling. Like when we do our meditation at the beginning this morning, said, you know, even after letting go of the sense of the body, there may be a sense of the I who is like knowing the knower, experiencing the knower, or experiencing the feelings. Actually, there are just feelings. There is just conscious experience. There's not an experiencer of that. There's not an experiencer of the mind that's different than the mind itself. There's not an experiencer of the feelings that we ordinarily have a sort of an intuition of. We have a feeling of, not a correct intuition. So we just go along with that. So according to the higher tenets, that kind of selflessness, that kind of self does appear to our minds. There is a variety of it that does occur to our minds naturally at birth, what we call innate grasping to that kind of person that's substantially existent and seems to be self-sufficient. And that, but that for the Mahayana, for the Prajnagika, that's called the gross selflessness of persons. For the Vaibhashika, for the Sautrantika, that's considered to be the subtle selflessness of persons. So we start to see, as we give these comparisons, the various tenet systems sometimes are refined by the higher tenet systems. They sometimes say that the lower tenets, you know, you might say, oh, why study these lower tenets if they're wrong? Right? Oh, I study the Bible. I just want Prajnagika. Why study Chittamatra or even the Hinayana tenets? Because the higher tenets refute these lower tenets, refine them and give, you know, a more correct view of reality. Why study the stuff that's wrong? In a world, that would make sense, right? You wouldn't want to study generally. There may be some sense in it. If you're studying mathematics, you wouldn't want to study some theory of mathematics which has been refuted, you know. You want to study that which is supposedly correct. So the lower tenets, though, the Buddha taught in his sutras in various times these different ideas as stepping stones, as maybe like the rungs of a ladder. In order to get up to the sixth rung, you know, or what do you call it, you know, step of the ladder, you have to get on the first step. You can't, unless you're an acrobat or you jump up there, you have to go on the lower rungs to get up, or a staircase. You have to get up to the top of the staircase, you have to walk on all of these steps. So the lower tenets are said to be very, very useful in understanding. You know, you first get to know the Vaibhashika tenets somewhat, and then as the Sautrantika tenets are, you know, explained to you, you can, and the refutations that they have of the Vaibhashika system, you can understand some subtlety there that may not be apparent to you if you only studied the Sautrantika. You can see the Sautrantika position in more clarity. Likewise, when you study the Chittamatra and even the Majjhimaka has two schools which are divided up into various sub-schools of those. As you study those, and the views become, the assertions of the tenets become more and more refined. You're saying that there's some error in that lower system. It's not exactly like this, it's like this. But to really appreciate that higher view, there's a great benefit in studying the lower tenets. So that's why this course is being offered, the four tenets, right? So from the these lower tenets point of view, the lack of a permanent, partless, and independent person is called, for the Vaibhashika, that's a gross selflessness of persons, whereas the lack of a substantially existent, self-sufficient person, the lack of that is called a subtle selflessness of persons. So 13 of the 18 schools, Vaibhashika schools, also assert the non-existence of a substantially existent or self-sufficient person. Sometimes we say slash. It's not one or the other, but sometimes you'll center on one of those things. Their assertion of selflessness does not mean that there is utterly no self or person, right? But refutes the existence of a certain type of self. For these 13 Vaibhashika schools, a person is not independent of the body and mind, It's like, so this group of six or five merchants, the self is included in there. It's not independent of that group. It's not independent of the body. I say, is not independent of the mind and body. So maybe we should say there are five or six of these. But is a phenomena within the mind-body complex. But it is the chief. It's the, whatever that word was that you said here. Some say that the person, if you check, is the continuum of the five aggregates. You know, the form aggregate, the five skandhas, form, feeling, discrimination, compositional factors, consciousness. Others say that the person is the mental consciousness itself. Still, you know, of the five aggregates. Still others say that a person is all five aggregates. For these 13 Vaibhashika schools, the non-existence of a self-sufficient person is known as the subtle selflessness of persons. The coarse selflessness or gross selflessness of persons is a person's non-existence as a permanent, partless, and independent entity. Through cognizing and becoming accustomed to the subtle personal selflessness, lack of a self-supporting, substantially existent person, the knot of cyclic existence is cut, according to them. According to Prasangika, this realizing the gross selflessness of persons, a lack of a self-supporting, substantially existent person, doesn't cut the root of samsara. It can help you to reduce the delusions, because a lot of our delusions are fueled by that sense of an enjoyer of the other aggregates, a sense of a self-supporting, substantially existent person. But realizing that that doesn't exist doesn't take the delusions up from the root, because it's still being fueled by a subtler misconception about phenomena. So, and one becomes an arhat when one has eliminated all of this, all of the delusions, by realizing the subtle selflessness of persons. So what is an arhat? Or the Tibetans take the etymology of arhat, which has this particular meaning in Sanskrit. They take it from the Buddhist scriptures, not just, the Tibetans didn't just invent this. They take the etymology, in Tibetan they write da chomba. Da means enemy, chomba means destroyer, or da means enemy or foe. So it's sometimes an arhat is called a foe destroyer or enemy destroyer. What enemy is it destroyed? Who's the big trading enemy of Singapore? Who do you try to get ahead of? Sell more than what? Indonesia or someplace? They might be your economic foe. It's not like destroying an outer foe. The foe destroyer is someone who's destroyed the foes of the delusions, the afflictions. Some, not just some of them, like from the point of becoming an Arya being, a noble being, seeing emptiness directly, at that point you have destroyed some of the foes, but not all of them. You've destroyed some of the delusions, right? And then as you successively meditate on selflessness over again on the path of meditation, you're destroying, ceasing more of the foes. When you've destroyed or ceased, you have a cessation of all of the afflictions. You are an arhat. You are a foe destroyer. You have destroyed them all. So there's a difference between arya and arhat. An arya is someone who's realized emptiness directly, but may be still destroying, still more things to destroy. An arhat is someone who's destroyed or ceased, has a true cessation of all of the afflictions. Okay? Does that make sense? So, simultaneous with becoming a foe destroyer, one attains nirvana, right? That's the name of that state. Say, for instance, if a person was in a body, and in that meditative session, they were just eliminating the last, they were ceasing, applying antidotes to the last of the subtle delusions. And in that meditative session, the next moment, they are free of those delusions. They've ceased them. They are an arhat. They've achieved nirvana. Same thing, right? You know the word nirvana. They no longer will take rebirth in samsara due to uncontrolled karma and delusion. As we said before, they can take rebirth by their own volition later, but they don't generally do that until much, much later. So the first state that's attained is said to be nirvana with remainder. Have you heard that expression? Nirvana with remainder. Have you heard that? Yeah. What does that mean to you? Oh, he's got the microphone because I didn't ask him. Yeah. So you know, I asked her. She was nodding also. Yeah. What is nirvana with remainder?
Still having the contaminated body.
Say again.
Still having the contaminated body.
Only the body.
Five aggregates.
The contaminated five aggregates. What do you think?
I'm not too sure. Yeah.
Ah, interesting.
Still have
yeah.
The contaminated
body. Is the mind still contaminated?
Because it's still with remainders.
You said, it was interesting, you said, still have the contaminated five aggregates. So remember we said the person can be divided up into these five aggregates. One of them is physical, the other four are all mind, right? So at that point certainly the body is still contaminated from the vaibhashika point of view, because the body has come about earlier when you took birth due to contaminated karma. And so it is said to be something which is a true suffering, and it's still there, even though your mind has gotten rid of all of the afflictions. So I think the mind is not contaminated then. The four mental aggregates are not. So you'd have to say, I may be wrong, you could check. You'd have to say the remainder is remainder of the contaminations that are left after you've gotten rid of all the contaminations of the mind. There's still a contaminated body. It's called contaminated because it's come about because of karma and delusion. Also, it's called contaminated because it can cause other people who see that body to generate afflictions. Now you might say, oh, well, wait a second, Buddha's body, supposedly the higher tenets, so the lower tenets believe Buddha's body is also contaminated. Like Vaibhashika, they believe the Buddha's body is also contaminated. It's an example of true suffering, but his mind is not suffering because it's uncontaminated. But some people might say that some of the higher tenets say that the Buddha's body is uncontaminated. So you'd have to say that what we see, those people that saw the Buddha's body and developed jealousy and envy, like Devadatta and so forth, they weren't actually seeing the Buddha's body, according to the higher tenets. They were seeing something which was a projection of their own mind. Okay, the Buddha's body is uncontaminated. But according to these tenets, the Buddha's body is contaminated. So simultaneously with becoming a foe destroyer, an arhat, one attains nirvana with remainder, the state of having passed beyond the afflictions, we say passed beyond sorrow, the chief of which is the conception of a self-sufficient person, right? We're talking vaibhashika here, that subtle selflessness of persons. They have passed beyond the afflictions, the main affliction or delusion or klesha, for the vaibhashika is a conception that there is a self-supporting, substantially existent person. So they've eliminated that. So having passed beyond that while still possessing the physical support, the body, that receives its impetus, that or had received its impetus from former contaminated actions and afflictions that threw you into that lifetime, right? So for the Vaibhashikas, when the Buddha sat under the Bodhi tree, he was on the what was called the path of accumulation, according to them. They do, according to the Theravada teachings, he did, you know, the very rare individual who becomes a Buddha accumulates merit for an enormous amount of time, maybe three countless great eons also. That's what the Mahayana usually says. But he's still, after all that time, he's still on the path of accumulation. Did you know that? Still on the path of accumulation? Sat on the Bodhi tree. And in one meditative session, he passes into the path of preparation. Sometime during the, you know, it's becoming twilight. Then he passes into the path of seeing, has direct perception of the Four Noble Truths and the selflessness implied by that. Passes through the path of meditation. All that evening, that one night, you know, when he's has the battle with the Maras, you know, the story of the Buddha sitting under the Bodhi tree, has to confront the Maras that are trying to prevent him from achieving Bodhi enlightenment. And in that same evening, so he started in the path of accumulation, entered the path of preparation, path of seeing, path of meditation, and achieves Bodhi, the path of no more learning, the fifth path. That's when he, you know, has realized he's become Buddha. That's when he is able to be given the name Buddha. So his body is still contaminated. It was the same body he sat down with, but the mind now is different than the mind when he started. The mind that when he started before, at the beginning of the evening, was still contaminated. He was on the path of accumulation, so forth. Make sense? Then at death, when someone who has become an arhat dies, and in the same case with the Buddha, the continuum of mind and body is severed, according to some of them, some of the lower tenets, not all, in a nirvana without remainder. So what does that mean? So for those who believe the word nirvana, when you've achieved nirvana and in a physical body and then you die, what is that called? Parinirvana. So complete nirvana. So when they achieve this parinirvana, like there's stories of there's this famous statue, I think that the one in Sarnath in the Mahabodhi Temple in Sarnath, not the Mahabodhi Temple in Bodh Gaya. There's a statue of Buddha in resting posture. Do you know that one? Has anyone been to Sarnath? Sweet Kim, do you remember that statue? Also in Japan, there's a famous statue. So when the Buddha passed away, he lied on his right side, lay down on his right side, put his hand on his right cheek, so he's lying down this way. His legs were out straight. I don't want to put my heels toward those images, and hand along the legs. You know, sometimes we're advised that that's a very good way to sleep at night, and certainly when you pass away, if you can have that same posture that the Buddha held when he passed away into parinirvana. Okay, so according to these tenets, according to Vaibhashika, for instance, when you're just about to die, you still have nirvana with remainder of the contaminated aggregates. Then when you the next moment when you die, there's no longer a rebirth. So according to these lower tenets, the mind does not leave and take another rebirth. What happens to the mind? It just ceases. They take the etymology of the word nirvana, which can mean snuffing out, to mean the snuffing out of the continuum of the mind. Whereas higher tenets say that's not what nirvana means. It means the snuffing out of the delusions. So at any rate, so the Vaibhashikas say that at that point there is a nirvana without remainder of the contaminated form aggregate. Before, you had still the, you had a remainder, what was, you know, you achieved nirvana, the mental aggregates were no longer contaminated, but you still had the physical form remaining there. You know, the body and mind were still connected. Then when the mind snuffs out, that's the parinirvana, the final nirvana, a nirvana without remainder of the contaminated aggregates. Well, aren't the contaminated aggregates still there? Yeah, the body is still there. You know, you have a corpse. The body, the Buddha's body, was still there when the arhats passed away. But the mind is no longer associated with it. We say its death, it has died, has passed into parinirvana. So, what do you think? Is there a person who attains parinirvana? What do you think? It's eerie. It's like he knows what I'm pointing to him. So what? Who, there's not a person who. So what would you say? It's according to these tenets. Well, let's say we said talk about. Parinirvana. So there is a state called nirvana without remainder, but there is no longer a person according to these tenets, because the mind has snuffed out, right? So there's not, although the state of nirvana without remainder exists, there's not a person who is abiding in that state. There is a person who was an enterer into that state. Maybe you remember, when we talked about the four kinds of aryas, what were they? Stream enterer, once returner, non-returner, arhat. Each of them was divided into two parts. An enterer into stream enterer was not yet a stream enterer, but was had all of the antidotes that would qualify to be stream enterer in their mind. The next moment they become abider in the state of stream enterer, and then enterer into once returner, abider in once returner, enterer into non-returner, abider into non-returner, then enterer into nirvana. So we can apply this also into the final nirvana. So in that final nirvana, that last moment, while the person's still alive, their mind has not been snuffed out, that person has obtained enterer into parinirvana, or enterer into nirvana without remainder. The next moment, if there had been a continuum, you would say abider in the state of nirvana without remainder, but there's no person there any longer. So they just posit one. They say there is a person who is an enterer into nirvana without remainder. Does this sound too complicated? Do you get some gist from it? A little bit, yeah. It makes some sense. So there is a person who obtains that enterer state, but then the next instant when their mind stream has snuffed out, according to these tenets, there's no longer a person. So the Buddha just disappeared. The arhats just disappeared. And there is not a person who would attain the state of abiding in nirvana without remainder. Wow, that's kind of interesting. Or not, depending. Okay. So then at death, the continuum of mind and body is severed in a nirvana without remainder. The attainer of the nirvana without remainder is thus said to be the foe destroyer who is about to die, because once dead, his or her continuum of mind and body has utterly ceased, and there is no one who could possess the nirvana without remainder. Just saying the same thing that I said before, just reading from here. Okay, so that's a particular tenet of the Vaibhashika. They talk about nirvana without remainder, meaning this state after death. Higher tenets, you know what the Prasangika says? Nirvana with remainder and without remainder. They have the same sequence. First you have nirvana with remainder, then you have nirvana without remainder. They posit a little bit differently. They refer to, say, the seventh level bodhisattva who, to take an example, who is about to eliminate the last of the delusions, because on the eighth ground, they'll become, they will have, and the eighth, ninth, and tenth grounds called the pure bhumis, the pure grounds, they will have eliminated, ceased all of the delusions. They will be like an arhat. You could even sometimes even say they're like a bodhisattva arhat. So in their meditative equipoise, there is no appearance, no remainder of conventional appearances. So that for the Prasangika, that's called nirvana without remainder. When they have a meditative equipoise on emptiness, so no conventional phenomena are appearing, that's called nirvana without remainder, and the implication is without the remainder of any conventional appearances. Then when they arise from that meditative equipoise, they're still on the pure grounds, eighth ground, ninth grounds. Again, they look around and they see trees and fences and houses and people, conventional phenomena. So that's called nirvana with remainder. So in a certain sense, the order is reversed. The meaning is a little bit reversed in the higher tenets. But here the Vaibhashika talk about it in this fundamental way. So according to Vaibhashika, although the upper tenets say if you become a foe destroyer, generally everyone is kind of the same level. If you become an arhat, if you've achieved nirvana, it's kind of like you join the club. It's not like some country club here where there's higher levels and lower levels or something like that. When you achieve nirvana, you all have the same ability. There's still different karmic imprints on your mind that may, while you're still alive until you pass into parinirvana, that may give different life experiences, but there's not generally not different categories. But the Vaibhashikas accept six types of arhats, six types of foe destroyers. Of those six types, they say that five of them, once they've achieved nirvana, can fall from that state. Did you know that, Sui Kim? You've heard? No. They say that five of these different kinds of arhats, five of the six, maybe the sixth one is the one who's a real arhat. Because according to the upper tenets, once you've ceased the delusions, if you've really ceased them, they will not come back again. Right? That kind of cessation is what's called an analytical cessation. I'm just trying to remember. What time do we finish? 3? Or 3:30? Okay. Got more to go. Got another hour. Okay. You okay? You need some coffee? Yeah. So, the upper tenets say, when you have a cessation, true cessation, that true cessation is a particular kind of cessation. It's what's called an analytical cessation. It's one that's due to wisdom, vipassana, that sees the antidote of the delusions, is meditated on it, and it's like uprooted the delusion so that it will never come back again. So an arhat for the higher tenets, let's say the Prasangika, arhat could never fall back, could not generate those delusions again. But according to the Vaibhashika, maybe because at that time there were people who developed shamatha, vipassana, And they had very high realizations, and they looked to other people, they looked like arhats. They might have even said, I am an arhat. Maybe out of exaggeration, maybe they thought they were an arhat. Because having diminished their delusions, maybe they actually had a realization of emptiness, but it had not yet ceased all of the delusions. Some of them were ceased enough that they felt, wow, I've reached it. I've reached the goal. Or they might have been, like today in the world, you know, we have teachers that say they are have high realizations, you know. Maybe they're just deluded or they have some other agenda, you know, to get disciples or something like that. But at any rate, so these five types of arhats, there were six altogether, which the sixth one did not fall, would not fall from that. But the other ones, due to like seeing an attractive person, might develop attachment and so forth, different kinds of things like this. These five then were said to have fallen from the state of arhat. Sometimes they fell, what does it say? Even to the path of seeing. So they wouldn't go back beyond the path of seeing. But remember, that's from the point of where they've reached nirvana. That's a long way back. You enter into the path of seeing, which is relatively brief. Then the path of meditation, very, very long time, meditating on emptiness again and again, and then achieving nirvana, arhatship. But according to the Vaibhashika, there were some who could fall from that. So I'll read again. For the Vaibhashika, five of the six types of foe destroyers can fall from their attainment even as far back as the path of seeing. According to other schools, however, such degeneration makes a mockery of the conception of total abandonment of the afflictions, which are called true cessations, the third of the Four Noble Truths. So, I think... I don't know if there are any, you know, today, are there any beings in Thailand or Malaysia or even here that are commonly, either in Thai or Malaysian or Chinese Buddhism, that are commonly renowned as arhats that are living in the world today? Last time I was here, there was someone, I think some of the teachers, maybe Ajahn Chah talked about some of his, some other forest monk who'd achieved nirvana. Until we have, we can't tell with our clairvoyance, even if we develop clairvoyance, we can't tell unless we are a higher level. You can't generally, with clairvoyance, know the mind of someone of a higher spiritual level than you. So how could we know? We're just sort of like, they look, you know, like a foe destroyer, or they look like an arhat, you know, or they act, you know, completely calm. Actually, the lamas say, if you develop real shamatha, if you actually develop shamatha and it has not degenerated, you know, you awaken from that, to all intents and purposes, if we look at that person and their behavior, we would assume they're an arhat. This is what's said. They behave because they've separated from the delusions of the desire realm. We're not aware of any delusions that still might remain in their mind of the form and formless realms. But to us, they look, you know, pristine. So maybe, I don't know, I sometimes think that some of these five arhats were people who had achieved these, even, not even necessarily the path of seeing, even if they had shamatha, people might have thought they were arhats. And then later, when that degenerated, that realization degenerated, because once you've achieved calm abiding, it's not something that will necessarily be stable. It might degenerate over time if you don't keep on enhancing it by constant meditation, going back into the causes that brought that about. So, another topic. The Vaibhashikas, despite being Hinayana in term of their tenets, so what does that mean? Generally, we talk about Let's say someone might be Hinayana by tenet, or Vaibhashika by tenet. That's what they're believing, but they might be Sautrantika in practice. That is to say, they might be actually practicing, intellectually they're accepting the Vaibhashika system, but they might be actually practicing the Sautrantika point of view. So it almost be almost like unbeknownst to themselves. Sometimes someone might be Hinayana by tenet, but actually might be a bodhisattva, practicing by practice, practicing the bodhisattva path. Probably most of us, maybe most of us are Mahayana by tenet, would you say? We believe, yeah, Mahayana, all the way. Prasangika, not just the lower one. We're Mahayana by tenet, by practice. Maybe we don't have real bodhicitta. Maybe we're not even Hinayana by practice. Someone who is Hinayana by practice would be someone really aiming, working to achieve liberation, having disdain for the pleasures, even though it's not, even though delusions can still arise, having, the firm determination that there's nothing within cyclic existence that's worthwhile. How many of us can say we have that kind of renunciation? So we may be Mahayana by tenet, but Hinayana by practice. Okay, so just to give some background. So the Vaivashikas, despite being Hinayana in terms of their tenets, accept a bodhisattva path. Did you know that? And sometimes when you hear the critique of the Theravada monks. There was a great Theravada teacher, I think two or three times ago when I visited Singapore, there was a conference in Malaysia. What was his name? He was the abbot of one big monastery there. Very jovial person. But at the conference, it was supposed to be a conference of the three kinds of Buddhism here in Singapore. I think it was Singapore, not Malaysia. When they say these conferences here in the East, they say Theravada, Chinese Mahayana, and Tantrayana. Generally, the Tibetan Buddhists would never divide up, have these particular categories. But anyway, that's what the conference was about. And the abbot of the Theravada monastery came up. We thought he would just give a nice general introduction. And he went into a long criticism of the term Mahayana, how it was demeaning to the Theravada, that the Theravada was Hinayana, lesser vehicle. So although there is that stream in the Theravada that either denies certain aspects of the Mahayana, like remember I told you Vasubandhu had originally said, oh, his brother Asanga was practicing the so-called Mahayana, which was like a sky flower, something that didn't really exist. Even though there's something like that, within their own scriptures, in the Pali canon, preserved in the Theravada, there are the stories of the Buddha's past lives, and there's acceptance of a bodhisattva path. Here it says, the Vaibhashikas, despite being Hinayana in terms of their tenets, accept a bodhisattva path that is trod by very rare beings. So, Shakyamuni was the one being of this era, according to them, who had tread the bodhisattva path over a long period of time, three countless great aeons, collected so much merit so that in his final attainments, under the Bodhi tree, He passed through these stages, which ordinary practitioners would not pass all in one sitting. You don't go through from the path of accumulation, the path of seeing, path of meditation, and then achieve arhatship in one seeing, generally. Only the Buddhas do that, or maybe some Pratika Buddhas do something like that. The one in our age that had followed the bodhisattva path being Shakyamuni Buddha. That they accept such is clear from their literal acceptance of the Buddha's life stories. the Jataka tales. Jataka is a Sanskrit word that means life stories, which recount his generation of the aspiration to enlightenment, his generation of bodhicitta, and his practice of the six perfections over many, many lifetimes before he became Buddha, while he was still a bodhisattva. Even before he was a bodhisattva, some of the Jataka tales are talking even before he was a bodhisattva. They also accept the literal, they also accept as literal, that means you can take it as it's written, the Vinaya teachings, the volume, remember the Vinaya Pitaka, the teachings on discipline among the Buddhist teachings. So amongst that, there are teachings that recount the Buddha's performance of the 12 deeds. Have you heard the 12 deeds? What are the 12 deeds? When any Nirmanakaya teaching, universal teacher, not all Buddhas are called universal teachers. There are many Buddhas, numberless Buddhas existing now, maybe some existing in the world. Maybe they're not recognized as Buddhas, but some are, maybe are here. But in any one period of time, there's only one universal teacher, one of the Buddhas who in... Sometimes there's no teachings at all. There are periods in life, in the world, in when worlds, systems exist, when the human realm exists, there's no Buddha Dharma at all. There's no existence of the Buddha in the world, because even now, Shakyamuni Buddha existed, 2,500, 2,600 years ago, right? So you can't say that Buddha Shakyamuni, there's an obvious that he's somewhere, that he's in, you know, South Africa, or that he's in Malaysia, or Santosa. If you go to Santosa, you might think he's there. I don't know. It's very grandiose. So the 12 deeds. When a universal teacher appears in the world, they appear in the world from having been previously the throne holder of Tushita Pure Land, which is in the same realm of the desire realm gods called Tushita. There's a desire realm, god realm, called Tushita. Not the form realm, not the formless realm. There's some gods of the desire realm, remember we mentioned? Like where Indra is and so forth. Well, a little bit below that, there's a realm called Tushita, and that's one of the god realms. And it's mentioned that there is a pure land called Tushita, which is kind of like a suburb in that god realm. So it has the same name. What would you say today, like a gated community? You know, not everyone can get in that. Even if you're in Tushita heaven, you can't get into the Tushita pure land unless you have the right credentials. You have to be, generally bodhisattva. So the person who is holding the throne, is the throne holder there, is going to be the next universal teacher. So at a certain point, when Shakyamuni Buddha was not called Shakyamuni at that time. He became named Shakyamuni, was given when he was born to the Shakya clan, the Muni of the Shakya clan. So he had another name. And he was, I told some stories, you know, with his proclamation, he said, now is the time to search for the womb that within which I will take rebirth. He knew all this already, but this was to show the sequence. So one of the deeds is a descent from Tushita into the womb of his mother in the form of, you know what did the mother dream in the night that he entered into her womb? With how many tusks? Six tusks. Yeah, so something remarkable. Someone else had mentioned recently about, where did that, why six tusks? Where does that ever come up? So that's the dream that the mother of a universal teacher will have when he enters into her womb. So that's one of the 12 deeds. And then there are these other of the 12 deeds, different demarcations that Buddha Shakyamuni himself exhibited. So it's said that all universal teachers, all universal Buddhas, remember, not all Buddhas are universal teaching Buddhas. There are many other Buddhas that appear, but if you appear as a universal teacher, you always have these 12 deeds. So the Vaibhashikas accept they accept as literal the Vinaya explanation, which recounts the Buddha's performance of the 12 deeds of a fully enlightened being. So that's interesting. So the Vaibhashika, the lowest of the lesser of the two Hinayana schools, accept that bodhisattvas exist, and when the bodhisattvas enter into the world as a universal teacher, to become Buddha, they enact these 12 deeds. So this gives some credence to the Mahayana, in a sense. I'll read a little bit more. The Bodhisattva path requires an accumulation of the collection of merit and wisdom for three periods of countless eons. We say three countless great eons. Whereas the path of a solitary realizer requires only 100 eons. So three countless eons, or three countless great eons, and 100 for a solitary realizer, what we are calling Pratika Buddha, they take 100 eons. How long does an ordinary Shravaka take to achieve Nirvana? You remember? They could achieve it in even one lifetime, from, you know, not yet having entered into the path, or two, three lifetimes. At the most, they would take how many? It said 16 lifetimes. It said that to keep that renunciation, that fierce renunciation, for longer than 16 lifetimes is very unlikely. It begins to diminish because you're depriving yourself of so many sense pleasures. So the Bodhisattva path utilizes these pleasures into the path. Lama Yeshe used to say that was a special feature of secret mantra or tantra, what we call Vajrayana. You've heard, right, tantra teachings. Special feature of that was that it utilized these energies that were generally in the Hinayana completely dismissed, you know, like sensual enjoyment, you know, embracing your consort or eating food or things. That's, you know, like when the Buddha, even when Shakyamuni sat with his five companions and started following the middle way, started to take some food because he realized that was, that extreme of asceticism was not going to lead to the goal. Even when he did that, the other ones kind of, you're a backslider. They left. They walked off. They ended up in Sarnath, where he eventually found them and taught them, right? So a solitary realizer requires 100 eons, whereas a Shravaka may achieve their Nirvana in one up to 16 lifetimes. Difficult for a Shravaka to keep that renunciation longer. How can they keep that up for 100 eons? Because the Bodhisattva, you understand, they're utilizing a different mindset out of compassion for sentient beings, also utilizing, you know, pleasures into the path, not the same way as Tantra, but in a way. How do the solitary realizers do it? Well, they're accumulating merit. They have sharper minds. They don't meditate merely on the Four Noble Truths. They take as their main analysis of samsara the 12 links of dependent origination, right? That's their main, so distinguishing deeper insight. And they accumulate greater merit than the Shravakas. They put more effort into that. And so they can remain longer, I guess. A Buddha completely removes both According to the Vaibhashika, there are two kinds of obstructions. The things that we are generally calling the klesha, the delusions, those are called deluded obstructions or klesha avarana. So that's the main thing that the arhats are eliminating. According to the upper tenets, you may have heard the term not only deluded obstructions, we say the obstructions to omniscience, someone said this morning, maybe KK said, or the knowledge obstacles, just a different way of knowledge obscurations, so shade dip. You can translate it in different ways. This is very short in Tibetan. So with knowledge obscurations to knowing all phenomena, so adding some words in, or to obstruction to omniscience. So here in the Vaibhashika, they don't use that term. They do use the first term. They talk about deluded obstructions or afflictive obstructions. Let's see what here it says. And there's also, according to Vaibhashika, the other set of obstructions that a Buddha eliminates, but the arhats do not, are called non-afflictive obstructions. So you might say, oh, that's the knowledge obstacles or the obstructions to omniscience. But they don't posit it that way. They say that there are certain obstructions that even the arhats have, like Shariputra and Mahamoggallana, that prevent them from knowing distant places, locations. Remember we talked about this one? Distant times, subtle features of the Buddhas and so forth. And the Buddha, having accumulated merit over three countless great eons, has eliminated these non-afflictive obstructions. So they can see all of these different distant places and so forth. A Buddha completely removes both the afflictive and non-afflictive obstructions, whereas the hearers and solitary realizers, though they utterly abandon the afflictive obstructions, only abandon the non-afflictive obstructions through non-attachment. So they don't really remove them, but they're no longer affected by those obstructions. That is to say, they're not adversely affected. They can't see distant places, so they're affected by them in that way. In the Vaibhashika system, the afflictive obstructions are the conception of a self-sufficient person and the three poisonous minds of desire, hatred, and ignorance that result from it. Have you heard that term, the three poisonous minds? So even though there are a myriad, 84,000 different kinds of afflictions that can arise, if you condense them down further and further, you can come down to this basic set of three. They call the three poisonous minds. So generally things that want to have things out of your ego sphere. I'm so proud of my invention, that coining that name. I think I should copyright it. Ego sphere, in ecology we talk about the ecosphere, right? The world and all the interrelated things that lead to a healthy ecology. So things that you want out of your ego sphere, you don't want impinging upon you, that are irritating, give rise to anger and repulsion. Those things that you want in your ego sphere are things that bring you pleasure, and so they generate attachment. Things that you don't care one way or the other, that can generate the continuum of subtle ignorance, neutral, that are things that just cause neutral feelings. So you don't mind if they're in your ego sphere or not. Sort of like something flies through your ego sphere. You're not annoyed. You don't want to try to keep it there. Yeah, say, you meet some people. You're very attracted to them. Even they want to walk away, you say, hey, can you give me your telephone number? You want to have them. You want to have them in your ego sphere. Some people, they come close to you and you'd like to just... You yourself would either walk away or you hope they go away, or it generates anger to keep them away. And you defriend them on Facebook. Is that still possible? Can you defriend someone? Did you ever do that? Did you ever defriend someone? Yes. What? Yes. You did? What? Okay, I gotta be very careful with you. I don't know if we've ever friended, but it would be really humiliating to be defriended. No? If they were a bad person, maybe that wouldn't matter if they defriended you. You might even feel happy they defriended you, right? So, the non-afflictive obstructions that the Buddha has eliminated, that the arhats have not, and the Buddha has abandoned, are ignorance of the distant, of that which is distant in time, that which is distant in place, the profound and subtle qualities of a Buddha, and the subtle objects, such as the subtle details of cause and effect relationships. For instance, to know what the present cause is going to result in, not just in general, but the specific time it will ripen and so forth. Those are the non-knowledge of that, the ignorance of those abilities are what are called the non-afflictive obstructions, according to Vaibhashika. So you could say, that sounds an awful lot like the obstructions to omniscience, but there's the obstructions to omniscience include many other things, and the state of omniscience from the Mahayana, and let's say the Prasangika point of view, is that the Buddha's mind, the omniscient mind, knows all phenomena simultaneously, directly, you know, at one time, right now. Knows the past, knows the present, knows the future, all together. Doesn't have to sort of switch from one to the other. Or according to Vaibhashika, the Buddha's mind might know all phenomena, but not at the same time. So it's sequentially. So it has to go from one to the other. Even though the Buddha has removed these non-afflictive obstructions, according to the Vaibhashika. Do you understand? So these non-afflictive obstructions are eradicated through a bodhisattva's great accumulation of merit. So the rare person, according to Vaibhashika, who achieves the state of a Buddha, who treads the bodhisattva path, is a person who eliminates those. So with respect to how practitioners ascend the paths, how they go through the paths, you know, path of accumulation, preparation, and so forth. The Vaibhashikas say that a rhinoceros-like solitary realizer, remember the solitary realizers, the Pratika Buddhas? There are different varieties. There's some that hang around with some of the other Pratika Buddhas, community-like, and then there are some that are called rhinoceros-like, that are more more fulfill the etymology of solitary. They don't hang around with other solitary realizers, Pratika Buddhas. Remember the one when the Buddha was about to come from Tushita, I told this story the other day, he asked some of the bodhisattvas, could they check where a proper place, a good place to take rebirth would be? Buddha knew already, but it's acting this out. And so some of these bodhisattvas came down to Saranath, and they noticed there was a group of Pratika Buddhas there. So they would have been not the rhinoceros-like Pratika Buddhas. They were the congregating Pratika Buddhas. There was a group of them. And this Bodhisattva said, what are you guys doing here? The Buddha's, the Buddha's about to come down from Tushita to be universal teacher. And they all went, oh, man. I just exaggerated about this. But maybe there was some thought similar like that coming up in their mind, thinking they had a firm determination to achieve their goal of their arhatship, their achievement of Pratika Buddha arhat when there is no teaching Buddha in the world. They want to. There's some commercial in America for soap, washing soap for dishes, and the line in the commercial in the ad is the mother is trying to tell the daughter which is the better soap to use or something, and the daughter says, "Mother, please, I'd rather do it myself." So they have that kind of attitude, the Pratika Buddhas. They don't want to have anyone around, you know, bossing themselves. A little bit like some of us, you know, Lama Zopa or some teacher gives us some instruction and then we leave. You know, we don't want to. We'd rather do it ourselves, become independent, you know, entities or something like that. I think there's some examples of that. So with respect to how practitioners ascend the path, the Vaibhashikas say that a rhinoceros-like solitary realizer, the one who's just by themselves, and a bodhisattva pass in one meditative sitting from the beginning of the path of preparation through the paths of seeing, meditation, and no more learning in one meditative sitting. Thus, a Buddha's body is an ordinary human body of matter and is a true suffering, even though there is no, even though it can no longer generate suffering for him. The Buddha's body is a true suffering. So he has that. He has a remainder, while he is still alive, he has a remainder of a contaminated form aggregate, but it doesn't pose a mental problem for him. Right? Remember this one story I told you. The Buddha was once taking the manifestation of having fever and maybe resting in his cot, and some of the monks were applying cold compress on him or, you know, fanning him or something, and they asked, how are you feeling? And he said, at least in the versions I've read, that it's almost like the royal, you know, the royalty sometimes refer to themselves as we. The royal plural, I don't know what that's called in so the Buddha said, great pain, great waves of pain are coursing through the Buddha's body, but his mind is at rest. So referring to himself in the third person, not in the plural, referring to himself as he. You know, how are you feeling? Oh, great waves of pain are coursing through George's body, and his mind is completely confused. That would be like the royal use of that kind of. Kings sometimes talk about themselves in the third person, I guess. So, the Buddha's. So this example is though the Buddha's body, as though he had achieved at that point, he'd achieved nirvana with remainder. He had not passed away into parinirvana, right? So he still, he could notice that there was some. He had a contaminated body that could experience pain, but his mind was not affected by that. I think that's quite interesting. Thus, a Buddha's body is an ordinary human body of matter and is a true suffering, even though it no longer can generate suffering for him or her. It is a true suffering because his body receives its impetus, you know, what through it, the inertia that brought this body was former contaminated actions and afflictions. Therefore, the Buddha jewel, when we talk, what is the Buddha jewel? Is that a jewel in the Buddha's eye? Does the Buddha have a jewel? When we say the Buddha jewel, what does that mean? We talk about the three jewels of refuge. The Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha, right? Did any of you know Dr. Nick Ribush? He had been a monk in the early days. He's been running Lama Yeshe archive for many, many years. So once he wrote a book review. It was some book that was published by the Library of Tibetan Works and Archives. I've told this story in other classes in Singapore. I like it very much. So he's quite clever, Dr. Nick. So he had seen some typo in this Buddhist publication. It referred to the three Jews of refuge. The three Jews. And he said, "Oh, I know Alex Berzin, John Landau. Who's the third?" That they were both. They were both translators at that time, you know, Buddhist scholars. They're still around. They're good, great, great friends. So he was joking, the three Jews, the three Jews of refuge. So when we say the three jewels, we refer to Buddha, the Buddha jewel. The word is ratna, right? We say the tri-ratna. I take refuge in the tri-ratna, the three jewels. That, so you want, you understand at that point, you mean the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. So the Buddha, therefore the Buddha jewel, of those three jewels, there's a one of the objects of refuge that we take refuge in is Buddha, one is Dharma, one is Sangha. The Buddha jewel that is the object of refuge only refers to the phenomena of no more learning in his continuum, according to the Vaibhashika. So that means you don't take refuge in the Buddha's contaminated body, according to Vaibhashika. His body is still remainder of contaminated aggregates, right? According to Vaibhashika. You don't take refuge in that. You only take refuge to the phenomena of no more learning in his continuum. What does no more learning mean? That's the fifth path. That means when you have achieved a cessation of all of the afflictive emotions, and in the case of the Buddha, the non-afflictive obstructions also, that state of mind is what you actually take refuge in for the Vaibhashika. Okay, any questions about Vaibhashika? It's just a some of the general things. Important thing to remember. I mean, a lot of them will come up in studying greater, the great treatises. A lot of these points will come up about arhats who fall back, or so forth and so on. The Vaibhashika, one of the important points, because the subtitle of this course is the four tenets, the two truths. So according to Vaibhashika, two truths, ultimate truths, conventional truths. For them, ultimate truths are things that can't be, the perception of which cannot be destroyed by either physically, breaking them, or by analysis. This still appears to your mind, such as partless moments, partless particles, physical particles. They can't be destroyed. They can't break them up. So you still have a perception, even though you try to analyze them. Partless moments of time, partless moments of mind, and emptiness, and the two cessations. There's said to be two cessations. Sweet Kim, you have a question.
Okay, my question is this. Like, for example, for Prasangika, when we realize emptiness, when we meditate and on the selflessness of a person, we arrived finally at ultimate truth, or we realized ultimate truth.
We realize ultimate truth before that, because when you meditate, it's a first realization, but. Way before, I'm not sure if you said the path of seeing, but certainly we, even before you enter into the path, even before the path of accumulation, you can realize emptiness. You can have an inferential cognition that realizes emptiness, devoid of concentration, it's just not very strong, not very deep, fleeting, yeah. But you can have a realization, yeah. Right?
But what you realize is something like the ultimate truth, right? Like the selflessness of a person.
You realize an ultimate truth, right?
So for Vaibhashika, you meditate on the emptiness of a self-sufficient, substantially existing person. Do you arrive at the same ultimate truth of that, what, partless?
Okay, so what you're realizing directly for Vaibhashika at that point is the impermanence of the five aggregates. Because that's the only, for Vaibhashika, that's the only thing that can appear to a mental direct perceiver or to the yogic direct perceiver. You can't perceive permanent phenomena such as emptiness or selflessness. But by your mind realizing the five aggregates as being impermanent, implicitly indirectly, you realize that they are devoid of being permanent. And so you indirectly realize that there is no permanent, independent person. So nowadays in Burma, I understand one of our monks had gone to Burma for some time, tried their meditation. They still have this tradition, which seems to be that if you realize subtle impermanence, you have realized selflessness. So from our point of view, as we look at the tenets, that would mean that they are considering the realization of the lack of a gross selflessness of person, or the lack of a gross self of persons. If you realize the gross selflessness of persons, the lack of a permanent, partless, independent person, that you have, that you've realized selflessness. Well, that's for the lower school, the Vaibhashika school, maybe some of the Theravada school today, that would be called an intellectually formed, or called the gross selflessness of persons. But the subtle selflessness of persons for them, the lack of a self-supporting, substantially existent person, is arrived at in a different kind of way, not simply by directly realizing impermanence. But still, as the selflessness is a non-affirming negation, it's just the lack of something, it can't be perceived by the mental direct perceiver directly. Using the word directly here twice in a different way. They say that they realize with a direct perceiver, the mental direct perceiver, the selflessness. That is, they're knowing it, but they're knowing it indirectly. They're not knowing it directly. What directly they know is the impermanence of the five aggregates. When you talk about the subtle selflessness of persons, the way that they realize that is not through simply realizing impermanence. Subtle impermanence is a different logic that's used, but the same thing would apply, that when they realize that subtle selflessness of persons, they're realizing it with a direct perceiver or bare perceiver, mental yogic direct perceiver, but they're not realizing it directly. They're realizing something directly, but they're implicitly or indirectly realizing the emptiness, because that emptiness can't appear directly to a mental consciousness. Mental consciousness, bare perceiver, only, according to Vaibhashika, only knows impermanent phenomena. Now, according to the Prasangika and some of the other higher schools, mental direct perceiver can know directly permanent phenomena. There's not that conception that the mental direct perceiver only knows impermanent phenomena. According to Prasangika, big difference with the Vaibhashika, the mental direct perceiver can know, not only is it a directly perceiving emptiness, it is knowing it directly. Emptiness appears to it directly. So for the Prasangika, permanent phenomena can appear to the senses, in a sense, and let's say the mental sense direct perceiver. Emptiness appears directly to it, whereas according to the the Vaibhashika, what is appearing is the impermanence of the aggregates, let's say, or another analog of that for the subtle. That's within its domain, what a direct perceiver can perceive. It only perceives impermanent phenomena. And so it's knowing this permanent phenomena, the selflessness, indirectly, kind of implicitly, not just kind of like with peripheral vision, like he has. Joking, like directly, it's like it's there, you're kind of knowing it. It's not like that. It's like you understand that's the case. The same way that you don't see an elephant in this room, and implicitly you know the non-existence of elephant in this room. You're not actually seeing the non-existence of elephant is is a non-affirming negation. So you don't see that with your eyes, but you can know that implicitly, indirectly, by noticing that there is no elephant in this room. Oh, you might have to check. Maybe it's behind the pillar, sort of crunched up or something. Maybe underneath the altar you want to check. Maybe there's an elephant skin under there or something. Does that make sense?
I think so.
Anyone else have a question? By Basha? Yes, yes. Mabel. Oh, you're pointing at someone else. Or you... No, no. I wasn't sure whether you were pointing for the microphone or you were saying someone else had a question.
Maybe in relation to what we were talking about, just in a little bit more simple way, could you please explain the difference between the four schools, or maybe Vaibhashika and Prasangika, or higher levels, how the object and the subject is related to? From my understanding, when we come to Vaibhashika, they talk about a truly existent object, whereas it's not stated into the higher levels. Mm. And if it's the case, could you please explain a little bit further?
Okay, I'll try. It's a little bit daunting. Of the Hinayana schools, let me see if I see, I have a chart here. There's one group of these schools called the Sarvastivadins. Even another, Mahasarvastivadins. Sarva, you know what sarva means? All in Sanskrit. Om sarva tathagata, all tathagata, and so forth. Sarvastivadins are referring to a tenet system in these 18 Vaibhashika schools. It's a subset, so it has other subsets beyond it that say that all phenomena are substantially existent. From the Mahayana school's point of view, that's not the case. Not all phenomena are substantially existent or truly existent. So they have their point of view is that there is this real world, this vessel world, so to speak, and our bodies and so forth, that do substantially exist. And they bring together with that some other levels of subtlety, but in a sense they say that these are true things. You know, how can you refute? This is almost like a modern-day 21st century. We're in the 21st century now. I have to remember that. When I was born, it was the 20th century. To 21st century person, you think, yeah, of course these things exist. These are true. How can you refute this? Otherwise you're some sort of lame-brained spiritual person, you know. So they accept that, and what they're refuting is one subset, you know, that the self, the way that we grasp onto the self is either being permanent, partless, and independent, or more subtly as self-sufficient, like the head of the aggregates, an owner of the aggregates, something not completely different than the aggregates, not completely the same as the aggregates, like the head trader, that realizing that can cease our delusions. So they put their emphasis on that, and they don't put so much emphasis on talking about emptiness of true existence. It doesn't come up in the Vaibhashika system. Whereas from the... So we jump all the way to the top, to the Prasangika point of view. From Prasangika point of view, there are various synonyms or theoretical synonyms of true existence. Why do I say theoretical synonyms? Because, you know why? For some two things to be synonyms, we mentioned in the lower class, what has to happen? There have to be eight pervasions. If it is A, it has to be B. If it is B, it has to be A. If you have A, you have to have B. If you don't have A, you don't have B. These eight are called the eight pervasions. So as true existence doesn't exist at all, it's just something our minds assent to, it can't have a synonym because you can't have a true existence. You know, to find a synonym, it has to be, if you have true existence, you have inherent existence. You can't have that kind of pervasion. So they're called theoretical synonyms. So for the Prasangika, these so-called synonyms, theoretical synonyms of true existence are inherent existence, substantial existence, existing from its own side, which according to various of the lower schools mean different things. For the Prasangika, they're all meaning the same thing. They have the same import. If something is supposedly true existent, in a certain sense, it means it exists the way it looks. It's true. And like you say, yeah, this is true. Come on. It's a mug. In that sense, inherently existent means it has the sense of saying that. In the sense of synonym meaning, remember, even though they're theoretical synonyms, it's that it has the same meaning, but something else arises to the mind, like when you say impermanence and product. Were you here when we talked about that? The concept of impermanence is a synonym of product. Something which is a product of causes and conditions is necessarily impermanent. If something is impermanent, it's necessarily a product of causes and conditions. They're synonyms. But they arise, something different arises to the mind when you say one. You can actually use the synonym as a proof of impermanence. Say, sound is impermanent because sound is a product. Even though product is a synonym of that, something you can, what resonates to your mind when you say product doesn't necessarily resonate immediately in permanence. You think of arising because of causes and conditions. It can arise, like you can imagine, oh yeah, sound comes when you beat the drum or you beat the cymbals or you turn on the hi-fi or something like that. So for the higher schools, all of these things which for the lower schools are different, or many of them are different, like inherent existence existing from its own side, for the Prasangika, they all mean the same thing. There's another analogy when we talk about Lohrig. Generally in the non-Buddhist schools, awareness, which Tibetan is lo, like in Lohrig, I think, what is that? Mati, I think, I'm not sure. Mati in Sanskrit. Ritpa, meaning cognizing. And Shepa, meaning knowing. Those three concepts in the non-Buddhist schools refer to something a little bit different when you talk about the different philosophical schools, the Samkhyas and so forth, they refer to different things. A little bit like having some overlap, but not being exactly the same. For the Buddhist schools, those three are synonymous. So it's a little bit similar. For the Prasangika, true existence, inherent existence, substantial existence are all synonyms, even though for lower schools, they're referring to slightly different concepts. So the sense of true existence, from my understanding, is that things appear to be, we assent to the view that the ultimate mode of that thing is in accordance with how it appears. Something that's truly existent. Let's say there are two modes of existence for things. The way that they appear and the way they actually exist. The mode of subsistence, or how they actually exist, and the mode of appearance. Say, for instance, if you dress up in a dragon costume for Chinese New Year, did any of you do that? No? Wei Qin does, I think, right? Someone does. So you dress up in some costume, you appear to be this dragon to a little kid, let's say, but your actual mode of existence is Wei Qin, or whoever is in that costume with you, if it's more than one. Or in America, Santa Claus. I don't know, do you have that tradition here? Uncle Charlie comes down the stairs dressed as Santa Claus, looks like Santa Claus. The mode of appearance is Santa Claus, mode of existence is Uncle Charlie. Right? So the mode of appearance of phenomena, if for them to be truly existent, the mode of appearance would have to be the same as their mode of existence. You might say, well, that exists. Yeah. When you just see Charlie without the costume, mode of existence is Charlie, the mode of appearance is Charlie, the mode of existence is Charlie. But when we talk about how phenomena appear to us, the way the phenomena appear to us is as though they exist from their own side. That does not accord with how they actually exist. That's their mode of appearance. The mode of existence is actually to be devoid of existing from their own side. There's nothing to be found there. So that's why they're said, in a sense, to be, maybe superficial sense, why they're called non-truly existent. You know, putting the right words again? Non-truly existent. Phenomena are non-truly existent. What we try to refute is true existence. So true existence is the sense that the mode of appearance is actually how it actually exists, is its mode of existence. Mode of appearance and mode of existence are the same. That's called true existence, if you were to posit that as the truth. So that is not the case. So there's not, phenomena are not truly existent. These other theoretical synonyms, like non-inherently existent and so forth, are referring to other theoretical synonyms, like for something to inherently exist, that would mean without you needing to label this as a mug, or to label Sui Kim, or to, was it Sub, what's your name? Sabina? Severely. Something like that. Without having the label, you're existing as severally from your own side. So inherent is something inherent in you, in the object of my perception. Without me needing to label you, and you might say, "Well, of course you don't have severity." Well, I'm not murdering her name. Exists, yeah, without having to be labeled, but. Before you were given that name, presumably by your parents, your mom or your dad, or if you grew up in an orphanage, maybe you had someone else give a name. Before you were given that name, no one who looked at you would know that you were Servadi or whatever your name is now is pronounced. I'm going to call you Sally for the sake of argument. No one would know you were Sally. So it doesn't adhere in you. You're not inherently Sally or whatever. You don't exist from your own side. So at first when we encountered this, it seemed, you know, because the concept of emptiness is very difficult to really understand. One has to tread very lightly. Don't assume you understand it right off the beginning. So to keep an open mind and hear more and more teachings, try to understand. So in a sense, some of the philosophical schools below the Prasangika, let's say the Svatantrika Majjhimaka, they believe there is an inherently existent Sally, or whatever, or inherently existent cup. That means there is something existing here from its own side, yet it only exists due to imputation on that inherently existent basis. So it's kind of a mix between the lower tenets and the prasangika, or you could say. So that's why these tenets can be seen as steps, a stairway to get you to, as you understand the lower tenets, when you're introduced to a slightly higher tenet system, in the higher tenet refuting the lower tenet, you can kind of see some subtleties there that didn't occur to you. You get a much better understanding of the higher tenet than you would have if you had just been introduced right from the beginning. This is the law. This is the tenet. This is the established conclusion. You say, oh yeah, of course, as though you always knew that from the beginning. You know, you become an inherent. I am a Sautrantika. I am a Chittamatran. You know, this is the way it is. Okay, I think maybe enough for today. So I looked at the calendar. We still have, I think we have altogether seven, we would have had seven sessions. So we had two today, so we still have five more sessions. We're going to continue on in the succeeding days. Next Sunday, I think we have two, and the Sunday after that we have two, and then the one final Sunday we have one, I think. Come again? Is only next Sunday is after, only in the afternoon. Thank you. Thank you. Okay, so we'll continue. Next time we're going to be talking more about the Sautrantika. If you have access to a book about the tenets, you might take a look. Sometimes there's so many more details, and sometimes it can be intimidating just to read without some guidance. But once you've heard this, you know, we're just talking a casual way, but introducing it, as you go back, if you read one of those books of tenets now, even though the terminology might be different, you might say, oh yeah, that's what George was talking about, or that's what we were talking about in class, and you can start to fill in some of the other details. It may give more details, it may give less than what we've talked about in class. This particular little snippet that I've been reading from, I took from Jeffrey Hopkins' famous book called Meditation on Emptiness. Big, thick one. So if you happen to own that, does anyone own that book? A couple of you? A couple, yeah. I'm not sure. I think generally in the United States, if you take just a few pages, if you photocopy or you reproduce a few pages from a book, you can use that. You can distribute that in classes and so forth for scholarly study, as long as you attribute it and so forth. So I'm going to check with Yen, who is very careful about this, that ABC doesn't do something illegal. You know, if it's legal, I'll see if I can have this made into a PDF. There's already a PDF. See if I can make it available to you. You can put it on your phone and you can read it there. So let's finish with just a dedication of our merits, because this whole, you know, in the monasteries also, they do, motivation at the beginning, dedication at the end. Is a spiritual practice. It's not just an intellectual, scholarly thing. To think that the reason we entered into thinking this morning about this subject was to, you know, to create the causes to achieve enlightenment so that we could benefit others. Benefit ourselves, of course, but not just with a nirvana, selfish nirvana, but to achieve the Dharmakaya, which is said to be the culmination of one's own aim, and to achieve the emanation bodies of, or the rupakayas, the form bodies of Nirmanakaya and Sambhogakaya, which are the culmination of the aims of others, how you can help others. So with that intention, we wanted to achieve enlightenment, we created merit today. In whatever way that this karma, these karmic seeds, ripen in the future, as they will, unless they're destroyed or something, they will ripen as something pleasant in samsara, because we've created contaminated virtue. But whatever way they ripen, rather than them just being experienced as some fleeting pleasure, which is just of the nature of suffering, some changeable suffering, may they become cooperative conditions for my continued exposure to the Dharma, hearing the teachings, thinking about them, contemplating them, meditating on them, achieving realizations, practicing the path of renunciation, bodhicitta, and the realization of emptiness, the bodhisattva path, perhaps encountering tantra, secret mantra, in this very life due to these merits. Due to these, the culmination of these merits, may they not expire, may they keep on bringing their results until I achieve full enlightenment, where I can spontaneously, effortlessly benefit all sentient beings. Very nice feeling. Thank you very much. Hope to see you again next time. On Tuesday, we're going to be continuing. Wait, oh, we'll be starting a series of four, Tuesday, Thursday, on the mind and mental factors. And so it's, you know, it doesn't require anything, any other preparation. If you haven't been to the previous course, you can still come. Hope to see you again. Take care.